This is an ABC podcast.
Maloela male ho eiki, moelele e taha kotoa, whatalofatu, maloelele, and good fella morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Marianne Gupu, live from Tonga, and I'll be your host today. Coming up today, critics slam a controversial law to bring Tonga's foreign relation under control of the king.
This is a slap on democracy's face. We've gone through so much in the past 40 years.
Also, pro-independence parties reject a framework on New Caledonia's political future. And the wait is over for Marshall Islands, who will step up on the field today for the first ever soccer match.
We're going to be playing for something much more than just ourselves. It's for the flag, it's for the nation, the people.
All that and more coming your way. I'm Marianne Gupu. Thank you for tuning in. But first, to some breaking news. The Pacific Islands Forum has officially shut the door on partners and donor governments from next month's Leaders Summit in Honiara. Tonga's Crown Prince and Foreign Minister, His Royal Highness Tupoutoʻa Ulukalala, confirmed the news after the meeting last night in Fiji, where Jeremiah Manila's proposal to lock out countries such as the US, China, and Taiwan was voted in. Discussions were cordial according to officials, but not everyone agreed with the decision, with Fiji, Australia, and New Zealand all voicing opposition. Since the start of the year, countries across the Pacific have grappled with dengue fever outbreaks. Tens of thousands of cases have been reported, with nearly 20 deaths recorded. It's a situation, as researchers warn, will only get worse as climate change fuels mosquito numbers. Lucy Cooper has this report.
In Samoa, mother of six, Falaningna Rapa'amo, knows the threat of dengue fever all too well.
Many children in our family were infected with dengue fever, including all five of my sister's children and my 15-year-old daughter. The children experienced several symptoms identified by the Health Ministry as signs of dengue fever, including high fever, vomiting, and stomach aches. But thankfully, they did not get to a severe stage that would be fatal.
Ms. Rapa'amo's daughter is one of nearly 8,000 people in Samoa to have been diagnosed with dengue this year. In the past week alone, there have been over 1,900 cases.
When our daughter was sick, we didn't leave it until it was too late. We saw the symptoms and rushed her to seek help. But parents should stay alert and identify the symptoms early and take them to the hospital before their condition worsens.
Dengue often has symptoms like the flu, muscle aches, nausea, and vomiting, with most recovering within a week. But severe dengue poses a much greater threat. In Samoa, to date, there's been six confirmed dengue-related deaths. It prompted this message from Samoa's Prime Minister.
I extend our deepest condolences to the parents and families of the children we have lost. Our children are dear to us, and the loss of a young soul is utterly sorrowful. Please seek immediate medical assistance if your child develops dengue fever symptoms. Do not wait until it is too late.
Samoa's dengue fever outbreak is one of many in the Pacific.
This year has been the biggest year for dengue in the Pacific in terms of numbers of cases that certainly I've seen, that WHO has seen at least in the last 10 years and probably for longer than that.
That's Dr. Mark Jacobs, Director of Pacific Technical Support and World Health Organization representative to the South Pacific.
For suspected dengue, we've had nearly 23,500 cases of suspected dengue this year. We've had more than 16,000 laboratory confirmed cases of dengue, and we've had 17 deaths.
Fiji has had the most dengue cases, peaking around 14,000, with numbers now decreasing. But for places like Samoa, the Cook Islands, and Nauru, they're on the upward swing. A viral infection that spreads from mosquitoes to people, Dr. Jacobs says a dengue outbreak is often triggered by an infected person entering a country.
The local mosquitoes bite them, and then the local mosquitoes go and bite locals. It's not that the mosquitoes fly over the ocean, because the mosquitoes that spread this actually only usually move around 100 metres or 200 metres in their lives. It's the people bringing it into those countries.
Unlike malaria, there's no medicine to treat dengue. So the aim is minimising the number of cases.
Reducing your risk of getting dengue is not rocket science. It's pretty basic. If you don't get bitten by mosquitoes, you don't get dengue.
As the world waits for an effective vaccine or medicine to treat dengue, scientists like Dr. Perrin Ross from the University of Melbourne are working to eliminate it altogether.
One of the big things we study at the moment is bacteria called Wolbachia. And these are naturally occurring bacteria that live inside insects, and they can actually block the transmission of viruses that mosquitoes spread. Part of my research is trying to develop different strains of Wolbachia to release around the world to control dengue transmission by mosquitoes.
Dr. Ross says Wolbachia is the reason places like Queensland no longer have local dengue transmission.
The bacteria that are being released around the world, it's reducing dengue by more than 50% in some locations.
But Dr. Ross says climate change is complicating efforts.
We do expect dengue to get worse because as things get warmer and wetter, there's going to be more places for mosquitoes to breed, and that's going to lead to increased likelihood of these viruses spreading around. That is going to lead to places where mosquitoes haven't been before and are going to be now.
Dr. Mark Jacobs from the World Health Organization says linking climate data is key to preventing future outbreaks.
We are working with the countries to try to link better the meteorological data, the weather data, with the human data in the hope that we can help countries start predicting when it's going to be a big year for dengue.
Back in Samoa, father of four, Kaneti Samoa, says the community must work together to protect those most at risk.
Our family is committed to collecting tin cans, old tyres and plastics, as these are common breeding grounds for mosquitoes.
Mother of four, Taloa Lam Shong, agrees. When all of her children contracted dengue, she was scared and worried, and advises other parents to take the deadly virus seriously.
If your child gets dengue fever, please quickly see a doctor so they can try and treat your child, because we are all hearing stories and news that many children have died from dengue.
Taloa Lam Shong, ending that report from Lucy Cooper. For more on this story, head to abc.net.au/news. In Tonga this week, I looked into a controversial new law that critics say reverses democratic reforms. It is sparking fierce debate, with a petition launched this week against its introduction. Although the government say it is just a technical change, veteran pro-democracy campaigners say the country is sliding backwards. Desa Thokanga Singa, president of Tonga's pro-democracy party, describes it as like taking 10 steps forward and 20 steps back.
This is a slap on democracy's face. We've gone through so much in the past 40 years to have in place the major constitutional amendments in 2010, which gave more voices, more power to the people in parliament.
The law is called His Majesty's Diplomatic Services Bill, and critics say it brings Tonga's foreign relations back under control of the King, Tubo VI. It passed Tonga's parliament last week, triggering a debate in the kingdom. In 2010, Tonga introduced democratic reforms to have more elected representatives in parliament and less power in the hands of the monarchy. For Ms. Thokanga Singa, the bill is a fundamental shift in how power is distributed in Tonga.
This new bill takes away the current Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the management of the administration of the ministry to become under the authority of a new board, which is to be chaired by His Majesty, and members of the board would be members of his Privy Council, and they would be given the power to administer and run and make decisions with regards to all the operations of this ministry.
Yet, Attorney General Linda Fulamwetu'i says criticism of the bill overblown, with the amendment being more of a technical change.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs is not dissolved, but is renamed as His Majesty's Diplomatic Service. This means the HMDS's staff is not subject to the Public Services Act.
She says the new His Majesty's Diplomatic Service is instead intended to bring all employees of the ministry under what's known as a Schedule 2 employee structure, where the King selects who he wishes to appoint to reserved roles such as the Secretary of Foreign Affairs. And she says the Foreign Ministry will still have a minister, secretary, and foreign diplomats and employees. The immigration portfolio was also included in the change, but the Attorney General says it will be under control of the Minister of Foreign Affairs.
The minister shall have the function to manage and enforce immigration responsibilities to ensure border security and the national interest.
Former Public Service Commission CEO Dr. Liamaka says that despite the reassurance of the government, the shift removes safeguards.
This totally takes away any oversight function and responsibility of BSC. All recruitment, all employment responsibilities, all appointment responsibilities, all salary responsibilities.
Pro-democracy advocate Lopez Sentuli is another critic. He worked alongside the late Prime Minister Akilisi Pohiva during the 2010 democratic reforms, and he says the issue is not whether the law is constitutional, but whether it honours the spirit of those reforms.
In 2010, was going to resolve such differences was through dialogue. And unfortunately, we haven't had dialogue on this issue. So we are back to the square one.
He says the bill consolidates powers the King retained over foreign affairs, the armed forces, and land and titles, and further weakens public oversight.
It shows the King flexing his muscles and saying, look, I have more power than the Prime Minister and Cabinet. And that's a dangerous situation. So we are going back to the pre-2010 days when everything that was done by the King and his minions are going to escape public scrutiny.
The Attorney General says the new oversight will come from the His Majesty's Diplomatic Services Board.
This setup has already been used in the HM Armed Forces Act in 1994. To date, there have been no problems raised with the administration of the HM Armed Forces Board.
As to who initiated the bill, she says,
the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and approved by Cabinet and now by the Legislative Assembly.
The bill passed Parliament without debate, something both Desa and Lopeti say is alarming.
It seems as if there was already a consensus amongst the members not to discuss this bill. There should be debates in Parliament, especially concerning huge changes like this bill, changes to the form of government, to the executive power of government.
I have great respect for His Majesty, but I must ask them, please have some thought for the voices of the Tongan people. Thank you. And this is when the people must remind him that we had democratic reform. And we should respect the people's rights to democracy.
And Desa says the petition launch on Thursday is urgent because the bill has already passed Parliament and now awaits royal assent.
We're making use of our rights in the Constitution to make a petition to the King, ask him to withhold his royal assent for this act of parliament to be deferred or taken back to parliament for consultation with the people, with the public. And if the consultations outcomes are that people agree to the bill, then go right ahead.
That's Desa Tokanga, senior president of Tonga's pro-democracy party, speaking there.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the era to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beach. I'm Marianne Gupo. To Papua New Guinea now, where a viral video capturing a young woman being physically abused by a mob of male students on campus at the University of Technology in Lae has sparked fierce online debate this week. The video shows the 20-year-old, who the ABC has chosen not to identify, being attacked despite being escorted out of the campus by security guards. The ABC has spoken to the woman's father, who says his daughter has been struggling with mental health battles. PNG reporter Belinda Cora has the story.
It has been described as a deeply disturbing video, a young woman being attacked by a group of men at a university campus. The video has been met with outrage across Papua New Guinea. And now the woman's father, Simon, not his real name, has spoken to the ABC, saying his family has lodged a complaint to police. He says he knows who the perpetrators are, as incidents like this have happened before.
But those people, that those students, they knew him. They were ex-schoolmates from late secondary school.
He says his daughter has been struggling with mental health issues for many years, since a bout of severe malaria. He himself is a former student of Lae's University of Technology and is calling on male students there to remove what he says is a culture of violence that didn't exist before on campus.
They had to, you know, misunderstand and RSA and made it public and all this, yeah. If this kind of situation happens, we normally, you know, call the security and security come and, you know, handle the situation. So we don't make this issue go out of hand and create a big problem and all this, yeah.
Dorothy Coach runs the community First PNG, an organization focused on assisting many young people during mental health challenges. She says the video and the sharing of it across social media without the young woman's consent highlights the lack of understanding in the mental health space and the widespread abuse of women in PNG.
I saw how the young girl, really, she was all by herself. There was no other female. Even the security officer was a male, and I would just, you know, the poor young girl must have been in such a total distress for that. So that is, you know, the first thing is that this is a wake-up call.
She is calling for the university to ensure that such mindsets on campus are punished so they and society can learn that what had happened was wrong and should not be tolerated.
For people that are sharing, you know, sharing those videos, I really feel that it's wrong because no one has gotten consent, you know, to share this video. Whether you know, mean to do it, you know, out of kindness, you know, because you want to, it's wrong, you know. As per, you know, our counseling code of ethics, you know, confidentiality is so important and you cannot judge. And that's really what's, you know, being happening right now, is that people are just not caring for her confidentiality and already, you know, making prejudgment as to why she was there.
For now, the University of Technology has commenced its internal investigations into what happened on that night And the ABC understands some of the students have been identified and have reported to campus authorities. The university has warned that following investigations, students found to be at fault of this incident will face the full force of both the university student disciplinary committee rules and further referred to the police.
That was our reporter, Belinda Cora, with that story. To New Caledonia, where pro-independence parties have rejected the Bougainville Accord, a proposed framework to aim at restarting dialogue on the territory's political future. The accord aims to pave the way for talks after years of tension over the decolonization process. This rejection comes just days before France's overseas minister is due to arrive in Nouméa for high-level discussions. Joining us now, the island business reporter, Nick McKellen. Malelele, Nick, how are you?
Good morning, Marianne. Very well.
Nick, let's just get right into it. Why have the pro-democracy parties decided to reject it, and what are their main concerns on this issue?
Last Saturday, the main independence coalition, the FLNKS, met in an extraordinary congress, bringing together the largest independence party, Union Caledonienne, and a number of smaller pro-independence forces. They issued on Wednesday a statement condemning the agreement that was signed back in July in Bougival in France, stating basically that independence requires full sovereignty, political independence, through a decolonization process framed by international law and recognizing the right of peoples to self-determination. Essentially, there's quite a long statement from the FLNKS, but they're arguing that this agreement signed in France is framed within French law, within the French constitution, and denies the pathway recognized under the United Nations for decolonization. There's also concern about voting rights, which was the trigger for violence and conflict last year. They describe the unfreezing of electoral rolls, the expansion of electoral rolls for the provincial assemblies as a red line. And yet that was an element of the agreement signed on the 12th of July.
Well, Nick, this is a big decision that's been made. How does this reject the Bougainville Accord, which affects the political climate in New Caledonia, ahead of the overseas minister's visit next week?
It's really caused significant discussion and debate about the way forward. There are some pro-independence parties that do have so far endorsed the accord, including Palika, the Party of Kanak Liberation, and UPM. There's been a long debate within the independence movement about the way forward, and that's true even for the largest independence party, Union Caledonienne, which is a mainstay of the FLNKS. So I think people will be digesting the reasons. The overseas minister, Manuel Valls, put out a Facebook post saying that clearly my door, and I quote, "My door will remain open so as to understand the reasons for this incomprehensible decision." I think there's an element of concern that although a majority of the parties who participated in the talks in France still want to support the accord, the FLNKS is a significant political player, and as was shown last year, there are people who are prepared to stand up against unilateral changes coming from Paris.
Well, like I mentioned before, Nick, France's Minister for Overseas Territories, Manuel Valls, is visiting New Caledonia next week. What has he had to say about this rejection, and basically what can we expect from his visit?
Valls is still coming next week to meet with all parties involved in these discussions. He has, you know, as I say, raised concern that he doesn't understand why the FLNKS has now rejected formally the draft agreement, given that negotiators in the FLNKS in Paris agreed to come back and present it to their members. Well, that's happened, and the members have rejected it. The FLNKS statement on Wednesday said that representatives of this main independence coalition would continue to talk to the French state but only about a pathway to a sovereign and independent nation. They also said they want bilateral talks with France rather than the continued negotiations involving both Paris and the so-called loyalist anti-independence parties. They want their president, Christian Taire, involved in the talks, which is a bit complex because he's in France, banned from returning to New Caledonia after being held in pretrial detention after the protests and riots last year. A key proposal is that there be a drafting committee from Valls to tinker with the wording to translate this draft political agreement into legislation that can be put to both houses of parliament in France and, according to the timetable, adopted by referendum next February. The FLNKS statement leaders have said they won't join that drafting committee. So there's a bit of a deadlock, and it'll be a real challenge for Valls to try and draw the independence movement back into this discussion, given the really strong statements made in their statement last Wednesday.
Well, looking ahead for New Caledonia's future and expecting what pathways remain for the progressing of the decolonization process if the Bougainville Accord is off the table, Nick?
Well, for some parties, it's not off the table. And the loyalists have put out a statement saying they want to, you know, participate in this drafting process to develop legislation alongside so-called moderate independence parties. So I think you'll see from the loyalists and the French state trying to split away some pro-independence forces from the main body of the FLNKS. At the same time, the FLNKS has said they'll participate in direct talks. They're also seeking United Nations support and support from neighbouring countries, particularly the Melanesian Spearhead Group, to continue a pathway under international law based on UN principles of decolonisation. Obviously, with the Pacific Islands Forum coming up in just a couple of weeks in Honiara, Solomon Islands being a member of the Melanesian Spearhead Group, this will be a time where there'll be some discussion about this, particularly given that the forum sent a high-level mission last year, whose report will be presented to the forum leaders in September. Look, there's a level of fluidity, a level of uncertainty. We'll have to see what Valls what rabbit he can pull out of the hat next week. But it's clear that this rejection is a major blow to the French government, who had hoped that they could push through this this change. It's clear that the pathway is going to be very rocky.
Well, thank you very much, Nick, for your time in updating us on this news from that end of the Pacific. But thank you very much, Nick, for your time.
Thank you, Mariam.
Thank you. That was the Island Business Reporter, Nick McKellen, here with ABC Pacific Beat. Welcome back to Pacific Beat, live here from Nuku'alofa, Tonga. A 19-year-old Australian tourist is set to face court today in Cook Islands. He's been charged with making a false declaration after he was found to be carrying more than 40 vapes. The importation of vapes and other tobacco products are illegal in the Cook Islands, and police say making a false declaration carries a penalty of up to 3 years. Fina Funua spoke with Cook Islands news journalist Talaia Mika for more details.
On the 29th of July, the 18-year-old tourist who is from Australia was intercepted at the Rarotonga International Airport during a baggage search. And then a total of 41 undeclared vape devices were discovered. Some were found on him and some probably from his luggage. On the same day, the vapes, we believe, were handed to the Ministry of Health from the customs before he was released, and he's expected to face a hefty fine. Mind you, the Ministry of Health deals with these kind of cases relating to vapes and tobacco if someone doesn't abide by the act or the bill. He was released, and then I believe the Ministry of Health went through the procedure and saw that there was a the law was broken, and then they informed the Ministry of Police, and that's when the ministry, a few days later, that's when the Ministry of Police started their try and locate him. They went to the accommodation where he was supposed to stay with some people, I believe, and he wasn't there during the first time they tried to locate him. And then earlier this week, he was contacted again, the accommodation, I mean, and he surrendered. I believe the Ministry of Police spoke to him, and then he surrendered himself to the police. The alleged vape smuggler was 18 years old, and he turned 19 earlier this week. So I believe he was here for a birthday celebration or with loved ones. And then he surrendered to the Ministry of Police, and he's expected to appear in court tomorrow. We also know under the Act, he is expected to face a hefty fine.
And speaking of the Act, it was recently implemented in Parliament. Vapes are banned in the Cook Islands. Could you describe the ban?
Vape, before the Act was implemented last year, it was still new to the Cook Islands. The Tobacco Control Amendment Bill 2024 was passed in Parliament around May 2024, banning the manufacture, import, sale, distribution, and whatever of imitation tobacco products. That includes vapes and e-cigarettes. It also increased the legal age to purchase tobacco products from 18 to 21. Penalties are really severe here. For individuals, they face up to 100,000 in fines or 3 months imprisonment. Well, for businesses, it's like 1 million. It is 1 million in fines. So for tourists, if they come over to the Cook Islands, they can only, including locals as well, they can only bring one vape device of up to 30 ml of e-liquid, only for personal use. And when they leave, it's either they take it with them or they surrender it to the Ministry of Health. Yeah, so they started implementing that. It was supposed to be the 1st of July last year, but they delayed it. So it started the implementation on the 1st of August last year. Yeah, the reason why was due to health concerns, and also because some of the really young kids in the schools were caught vaping. So that's when the Ministry of Health stepped in to do something about it while it's still young here in the Cooks. But this is the first ever arrest that the police has done and the Ministry of Health since the ban was implemented, the Act was implemented last year. So we're looking forward to what the court will have to say about it in court.
That was Cook Islands news journalist Dalaya Mika.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, today is what's known as VP Day. It stands for Victory in the Pacific, and it commemorates the surrender of Japanese forces and the subsequent end of Second World War. But as Carl Evans reports, 80 years on, the scars of war remain, and some fear that one day soon, history may repeat itself.
Papua New Guinean Cecil Abel rarely spoke about the Battle of Milne Bay, during which he served aboard a transport ship, taking troops in and out of combat. But one soldier spoke about him often.
My father attended the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Milne Bay. He spoke of General Close told him to go and rescue a soldier who had been shot in the stomach. And of course, he didn't have to, but he and his captain, Sela, local captain steering the boat, they agreed.
Cecil has since passed away, but his son, Andy Abel, knows his father's history well.
But during the course of telling the story of this soldier that he rescued, that very soldier, his name was Harry Triffitt, stood up at the end and said, "That was me that you rescued." And it was obviously a very moving time, not only for my dad, but everyone in that gathering. And Harry Triffitt survived the war. He lives in Tasmania and he has 29 grandchildren.
Harry was one of the lucky ones. Close to 150,000 Allied troops died in the Pacific Theatre during World War II. Just as many islanders, if not more, suffered the same fate, along with 2 million Japanese servicemen, as battlefield historian and TV presenter Matt McLaughlin explains.
The Germans and the Japanese were really only allies because they shared the same goals of sort of dominating their sectors of the world. And basically what was happening in the Pacific was that Japan wanted resources in Asia. Japan was very resource poor, as it still is today. It imports a lot of its resources. And because it was aggressively expanding in Asia, countries were starting to cut off the supply of resources it was receiving. So in the end, Japan decided it had enough. It needed to be self-sufficient, and to do that, it needed to basically invade territories in Asia. And because of that, it also spread into the Pacific, because the Pacific was the key to defending its gains in Asia.
Several of the bloodiest battles of the war followed, as Japanese forces expanded as far south as PNG and also Solomon Islands. But Allied victories pushed the fighting north to Micronesia, and eventually to Japan's doorstep, where they refused to yield.
And the Japanese were planning one final cataclysmic battle. They knew they couldn't win the war, but they thought, well, if we just bleed the Allies enough, we'll get better terms when it comes to peace negotiations. It's difficult to think about it today, but they were planning this one last cataclysmic battle on the Japanese islands themselves, and it was only the dropping of the atomic bombs that convinced them to surrender before that happened.
That surrender came on August 15, 1945, 80 years ago today. For the Allies, victory meant peace and a promise to return home. But in parts of the Pacific, the price of victory is still being paid. Munitions, landmines, and unexploded ordnance left over from the conflict still litter the islands to this day. It's impossible to ascertain the scale of the problem, simply because no systematic survey has ever been carried out.
Well, at the end of the war, everyone was just in a hurry to go home, as simple as that. There was theoretically a mandate to dispose of stockpiles that existed, and a lot of stuff was just dumped in the sea. And even in dumping in the sea, they were supposed to take it out to very deep water and get rid of it, and that just simply didn't happen.
John Rodsted is a researcher at SafeGround, an organisation which works to minimise the impacts of weapons of war through research and victim assistance. He says the fear of being blown up prevents many islanders from accessing what would otherwise be prime agricultural land.
But people often say, look, we fish, we do stuff with the ocean, we don't go farming. We might have a little market garden around the house. But the fear of actually turning the earth and going and getting some proper crops in, which is going to give them some good health and some good economic return, a lot of places they just don't do it.
He says even densely populated urban areas aren't totally safe.
In Honiara, capital of the Solomon Islands, 3 years ago, there was a church barbecue, and they just lit a fire on the ground, getting the fire prepared, and an American 105 artillery shell detonated from under the ground, and it killed two of them and injured a few others.
The people of the Northern Mariana Islands in Micronesia, meanwhile, paid a different price post-war in that the soldiers never left. Islands that were heavily fought over, like Guam and Saipan, remain military hubs to this day, so much so that Guam is now known as the tip of the spear of the US armed forces. But despite the economic security the military's provided for those islands, some locals, such as Saipan-based lawyer and anthropologist Issa Ariola, feel it's come at the cost of cultural identity.
The land is really central to our identity. And so when these things are used for training or testing or really, you know, local voices are completely disregarded in the process, that's a hit to Indigenous sovereignty, and it will continue to be.
Another view is that the military's continued presence in the Pacific is central to ensuring a war like the one we saw 80 years ago doesn't happen again. Only this time with the US's geopolitical adversary, China. This week, a ceremony took place on the island of Tinian to mark the resurfacing of a runway used in World War II, the very same runway that launched the infamous plane Enola Gay, which dropped the first atomic bomb on Japan. Tinian-based author and politician Don Farrell says it's a message to China that the US is ready if war makes its way to the Pacific again.
And what the message is to China is that we don't want a war, we don't want to fight, but we won't get caught with our pants down again like we did at Pearl Harbor, that we will have operational bases prepared to become fully operational should the need arise.
Tinian-based author and politician Don Farrell ending that report by Carl Evans. Turning to sport now, and in just a few hours' time, a national soccer team representing Marshall Islands will step out onto the field to play their first ever international match. Their opponents will be the side from the U.S. Virgin Islands, and the game is being played in the heart of the Marshallese diaspora in the United States, U.S. state of Arkansas. As Richard Ewood reports, the match will signal mission accomplished for the Marshalls coaching team, who began work to build a team from the ground up less than 3 years ago.
The story of the last country on earth without a soccer team has made headlines around the world, and for the last few days, local TV in Springfield, Arkansas has been taking a keen interest.
The team's management says this week's practices were the first time that many of these players have ever met in person.
It's taken time because to build a national team from nothing takes a lot of work. Right. So we've got players in the Marshall Islands, in Majuro, on Kwajalein, and we've also got some players US-based. We've got players from places like Hawaii with the heritage from the Marshall Islands. So we've been sticking this group together.
Justin Wally talking to 5 News. Justin is one of the English coaches who has been involved with the Marshalls project pretty much from day one. The group of players he referred to arrived a few days ago to prepare for international debuts that will go down in the history books.
We're going to be playing for something much more than just ourselves. It's for the flag, it's for the nation, the people.
Definitely feels like an honor to be able to step up to my national team and to be able to represent where I'm from.
Being selected to defend our nation's badge and to just go out and leave it all out there for your country, for the islands.
I don't know, I think it means everything, you know. Growing up Marshallese in America, I think that this is a great opportunity to get out there and represent the country.
Just doing what we love, but for our country, it's going to mean 10 times more.
It's crazy to even say, like, we're the islands because, like, we've never had a team before. So being selected to go out and compete against other countries to defend the badge of our country, it's kind of surreal.
The Marshalls head coach, another Englishman, Lloyd Hours, started the ball rolling in December 2022. And now he's with his team in the heart of Arkansas's Marshallese community, as reflected by another local TV station, KNWA.
And with the Marshall Islands Soccer Federation in town this week for its first ever international 11A-side soccer match, our community is taking the time to help the team feel right at home. Tonight, Mount Sequoia held an opening celebration with remarks, a cultural exchange, and opportunities to meet players and coaches from the Marshall Islands.
In 2.5 years, you know, we've gone from zero activity in the Marshall Islands itself to now this. But over the journey, we've come across the Marshallese population and people in Northwest Arkansas all over the place all the time, and they're so supportive to what we're doing, to the extent that this is now our base, this is our US home.
It's been quite a journey for Lloyd Hours, who coached in Canada, England, Sweden and the United States before he found his way to the Marshalls. At first he says it was like he'd landed on Mars, but attitudes have changed a lot in the 2 years since his first trip.
First time I went was July 23. It was news to everyone, you know, news of me being in a new environment, news to everyone else thinking, like, why are these people coming into the country and why are they starting football, why are they starting soccer? So now it's a case of every time you go, it's so much more of a reception. You know people, there are people that want to help you all the time, and that's always been the case, but now it's a bigger level. And it's to the point now where you literally are in supermarkets and people will talk to you about the sport, whereas 2 years ago, that wasn't happening. But yeah, it's fantastic. Now that you go there every time, you are just meeting new people that want to help in new ways. And we're discovering new players all the time. 2 years ago, we didn't even have youth playing the game, whereas now we have 200 kids a week playing in schools.
Included in the Marshall squad is the son of a senator, and there's not much doubt about what the chance to play for his country means to this young player.
Anybody in a Marshallese soccer jersey, like playing, going against another country, I never envisioned that, especially myself. My name is Aaron Anatop Rockin. I'm 17 years old. I love to play soccer. I've known it my whole life. This is the happiest I've ever been, I think. But obviously, this is just the first step. Got a lot more to come, and I can't wait for that.
And so the clock is ticking down to Marshall Islands finally shedding that title of last nation on earth without a soccer team. The kickoff is at 8 p.m. in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. That's 1 p.m. in Majuro.
Richard Ewart reporting, and good luck to the Marshall Islands team for that historic game against the U.S. Virgin Islands. And they have a second match to look forward to in 2 days' time against the Turks and Caicos Island. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top stories, critics slam a controversial law to bring Tonga's foreign relation back under control of the king.
This is a slap on democracy's face. We've gone through so much in the past 40 years to have in place the major constitutional amendments in 2010, which gave more voices, more power to the people in parliament.
We'll be back at the same time on Monday. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. Marianne Gopo here from Tonga. Goodbye, everyone.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitey, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.